And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day for the Trump trial. Why? Because it's leading up to a weekend recess. An adjournment just for a couple of days, and then they're back at it. Today, there were a total of three witnesses. Part of the testimony of David Pecker of National Enquirer fame, plus two very close associates of Donald Trump, including his personal assistant, Rona Graff. What did we learn from any of this? Andy McCarthy, who is my favorite and most relied upon legal observer, he is a veteran prosecutor. He is a senior fellow at National Review Institute and a contributing editor to National Review. And his most recent question, which is posed in his most recent column about this trial, is, did the cross-examination of Pecker help or hurt the Trump defense? Andy, what surprised you about the cross-examination of someone who, by the way, in court, apparently, as part of his testimony, described himself as a present and longtime friend of Donald Trump? How did the cross-examination of Pecker perhaps damage the Trump defense?
Well, I'm of a mind, Michael, that when you have a witness who's a friendly and he hasn't hurt you on direct examination, my temptation always would be to actually waive cross-examination to try to signal the jury that none of this hurt me. And at least my theory of this case, which may, unfortunately for Trump, may be very different from Judge Marchand's theory of the case, is that what they call a scheme or a conspiracy among Trump, Michael Cohen, and Pecker to basically suppress politically damaging information by this catch and kill idea, where they would purchase the rights to the stories of these women and then make sure they didn't get published. I don't think that's at all illegal, let alone a conspiracy. A conspiracy is an agreement to commit a crime. That's not a crime. It's actually, non-disclosure agreements are a staple of civil litigation and settlements in the United States. So since I don't think Pecker offered evidence that Trump committed a crime, and Pecker was otherwise a favorable witness toward Trump, I would have done very little with him on cross-examination other than try to signal to the jury that he hadn't hurt me. And instead, what the Trump team did was kind of go after him. They went after him to try to distance Trump from the suppression of the Karen McDougal story. McDougal is the former Playboy model who alleges that she had an affair with Trump in, I think it was 2006. And then I think more damaging potentially is that there was a lot of testimony about Pecker's understanding that he or his concern that he violated the campaign finance laws, which should not be admissible evidence against Trump, but which the state will use to argue that Trump knew that he had violated a federal campaign law and that that was the reason that the business records were falsified to conceal that crime. So I don't know why you would go after him, particularly on, you know, to try to distance Trump from activities like the catch and kill scheme that it looks like he was involved in. If you don't think that's a crime, then there's no point trying to distance him from it, because when the evidence comes out that he was actually involved in it, it's going to look like it's more harmful if they, you know, energetically tried to distance him from it. So I really don't understand quite what they were trying to do in there.
Again, obviously, Trump's biggest concern is to move on past this trial, whatever the results of this trial. And I think you've written very effectively and persuasively that it's unlikely that the jury will be unanimous in finding Trump guilty. Is it possible that spending 6 weeks in this context, when you're talking about two alleged affairs with two different people, one a playmate, she's not only a Playboy model, she was a Playmate of the Year. And yeah. And then with Stormy Daniels, that this whole association for 6 weeks of him showing up in court every day and talking about a personal life that maybe is not exactly up to the most honorable standards that many of President Trump's conservative believers would honor, that he could be damaged even by the distraction of this case and the fact that it's not the end. This, though, you believe, first of all, this is probably the only one that's going to have a completed trial before the election, right?
I think that's highly likely, especially if the Supreme Court gives any relief to Trump on the immunity question. Like if they send it back to the lower court for more proceedings, then I don't see how that case gets to trial. I don't see how the Mar-a-Lago case gets to trial, and I don't see how the Atlanta case gets to trial. So there's a very good chance this will be the only one. I'm not sure, Michael. You know, I think that with respect to Trump's checkered past, he's been a celebrity in New York and nationally since the 1980s. I don't think anybody is all that surprised by the affairs. That's kind of baked in the cake with Trump. If you already like Trump, you've already factored that in. If you don't like him, you probably already didn't like him. I don't know that that's going to move the needle one way or the other. And you have to discount it by how put off people may be becoming over how overt it is that the Democrats are weaponizing law enforcement powers against a political enemy, which I think is actually an argument for Trump that's getting traction.
And which may be why there was much less publicity than I would have expected to this new series of indictments in Arizona, where
I think you're totally right about that.
Yeah, and there Trump is not personally indicted. He is mentioned as an unindicted co-conspirator. That was the same thing that they held against Nixon. What about that trial? Is that that's going to be after a new president is inaugurated, right?
I would think so. I mean, it's pretty late in the year. I know April, the end of April, is not late in the year, but it's late in the year in terms of like trying to get a case to trial. And let's not forget some of the people who were indicted in that case. I'm thinking in particular of Mark Meadows and Rudy. I think were indicted. Their dance card's already kind of full because they're indicted in the Georgia case as well. And I think one of or both of them will end up being probably Meadows will be a witness in Jack Smith's prosecution if he can ever get that off the ground.
There's also Jenna Ellis, who I think is also she was indicted in Arizona as well. And she, according to reports, is cooperating with the prosecutors. Is that right?
I think she's also cooperating with the prosecutors. I think that was part of her plea deal in Georgia. But the thing is, you know, it kind of reminds me of this issue that's come up with Bragg's case, where you have a lot of reporting that his case is very strong because there's all this evidence. And what I've tried to point out is that it's not hard at all for prosecutors to amass mountainous evidence of things that don't violate the law. You know?
Which be the case here. When we come back, we have a chance to talk about the Supreme Court and their pending decision about immunity and about the campus protests. What do they mean for America at large? We'll be right back with the one and only Andy McCarthy.
More of Michael Medved in a moment.
Michael Medved Show, speaking to Andrew McCarthy, who is a senior fellow at National Review Institute and a contributing editor at National Review. He was a very distinguished and veteran federal prosecutor and helped to advance the war on terror for the United States. His most recent columns are posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. Andy, right now the world is awaiting the final judgment by the Supreme Court with spirited oral arguments yesterday. And I think a lot of people were surprised that the court seemed uncertain about that distinction between official acts and personal acts. And with a number of the justices, and perhaps a majority, acknowledging that maybe there is an immunity for your engagement in official acts. Just as an example, it was an official act, was it not, when President Obama ordered the assassination of Osama bin Laden?
Yes, that's absolutely an official act.
And
yeah, you've totally homed in on what the issue is. I think there was an interesting narrowing of the dispute in the sense that the court, and I'm thinking of Justice Gorsuch in particular, got the government lawyer, Mike Dreeben, to agree that there's a core of presidential power that Congress would not be permitted constitutionally to enact criminal statutes that would interfere with the president's carrying out of those duties. And Gorsuch pointed out, well, look, you may not want to use the I word, you may not want to call that immunity, but if you can't prosecute him over that stuff that he does, then that's immunity. And on the other side, Trump's lawyer conceded that there were a number of things that are charged in the indictment that are not official acts, that are actually private acts. So I think that was an interesting narrowing of the dispute. And I think there's a chance here that they will remand the case to Judge Chutkan for her to conduct hearings to determine, going through the indictment, which acts are public or, as you say, official, and which are unofficial. And if she if they do that, there's no way this case gets to trial, I don't think. Not this year.
And what if President Trump wins the election? I mean, everybody is asking the question, would he pardon himself? He probably wouldn't have to. He could simply order dropping any of the federal cases against him, couldn't he?
Well, he could do that, and he should be able to do that constitutionally speaking. I'm not speaking now about whether it would be, like, policy-wise a good thing to do. Would he have the power to do it? Yes. The thing is, if you remember, they tried to drop the case against General Flynn toward the end of Trump's term, and the judge in the case, who was an activist left-wing judge, would not allow them to do that and basically waited out Trump to put him in a position of having to pardon Flynn if he wanted to get Flynn from out from under that. That could end up happening. Judge Chutkan could refuse to entertain a government motion to dismiss the indictment. I don't see what constitutional authority she would have to do that, but Emmett Sullivan, the judge in Flynn's case, got away with that. So that she could try that. I think that he wouldn't have to pardon himself because he could ask the Justice Department to dismiss it. But I think the other thing we have to keep our eye on, Michael, is the Democrats have a good chance of retaking the House. So the minute Trump tells the Justice Department to dismiss the case, then the Democrats in the House will impeach Trump and we'll be, right back to 2019 again.
Well, yes, we've seen that movie before. And speaking of movies we've seen before, right, and remakes and reruns and sequels, not always successful. So meanwhile, talk about successful. These university protests all around the country, which are so impassioned and so radical, have you been surprised by that? I will admit that I have.
It's hard to look at it and not be appalled. I wrote a book in 2010 called The Grand Jihad about the collaboration between, the Marxist left and Sharia supremacists, or, you know, what we call Islamists. I don't think there's anything new about this. I don't think we ought to be too surprised. If the Muslim Students Associations, which are tentacles of the Muslim Brotherhood, started really under Saeed Qutb in the 1960s. And if you let something like that go for 60 years and don't do anything about it, then one day you wake up and, like, every campus in North America has two or three chapters of the Brotherhood's Muslim Students Association in it. And it's always been an agitator group. And they've always had operational partnerships with the radical left. So now I think we're seeing a crescendo of this. We're seeing some critical mass of it. I've been following it very carefully because I went to Columbia, which seems to be the worst of it at the moment. And it's appalling. I mean, these are pro-Hamas demonstrations. These are not, I know people have different euphemisms for them, but, you know, Hamas is a terrorist organization. And if you're honest about what the rhetoric going on in these demonstrations, rhetoric and worse, by the way, these are pro-terrorist demonstrations under circumstances where we're dealing with a terrorist organization that's been designated under American law for almost 30 years and where it's a crime to lend it material support.
All right. And again, if you were speaking to somebody who's emerging from his tent at the Harvard Yard or at Columbia, your alma mater, what's the one point you would make most quickly about why it's idiocy to support it's idiocy and evil to support Hamas?
Boy, you know, if you're out supporting Hamas, it's hard to reason with somebody who's gotten to that point, because October 7th, I don't know what I could say about the last 30 years when October 7th is so fresh in our memory and we all saw it with our own eyes. That's the most disturbing thing about this.
Well said. As always, Andrew McCarthy, his most recent columns noted at our website at michaelmedved.com. Meanwhile, a challenge to Beijing from Antony Blinken. Really? We'll get to it coming up on The Medved Show.
The Michael Medved Show, all across America.
I consider myself a liberal. Your show is very entertaining.
This is The Michael Medved Show. More of Michael Medved in a moment.
On the Michael Medved Show, for the last segment of the week, it is a week of a Jewish holiday, the holiday of Passover, which is actually 8 days, not one or two, if you're following the biblical directive. And I'm here as part of a Passover retreat program with more than 800 people participating, and it has been a great lift to the spirits to be here in the Arizona desert as a part of that experience. Meanwhile, we also have a new film coming up that's called Unsung Hero that I've seen. It opens today. It is a film from a faith-based base, and it's something that I know you will be interested in. There's also reasons to be interested in Secretary of State Blinken, who took a trip to China and told Chinese officials about our concern for the Chinese support for Russia amidst the ongoing war in Ukraine. Clip 7.
When it comes to China's support for Russia's defense industrial base, all I can tell you is I was extremely clear about our concerns in some detail, but we'll have to see what actions follow from that. Now, I think China has demonstrated in the past when it comes to Russia and Ukraine that it can take positive action. You'll recall that well over a year ago, we had concerns that Russia was considering the possible use of a nuclear weapon. And I believe that China's voice was important in, at least at that time, moving Russia away from that that possible course of action. But now it is absolutely critical that the support that it's providing, not in terms of weapons, but components for the defense industrial base, again, things like machine tools, microelectronics, where it is overwhelmingly the number one supplier to Russia.
Okay, these are all reasons to work, and I believe at least Secretary of State Blinken, if not the other members of the administration, understand that one of the crucial challenges here is to prevent China and Russia from combining as part of a new axis of evil, to keep some distance at least between the Chinese and their self-interest and the self-interest of the Russians, who are in the midst of trying to destroy and commit mass murder against the people of Ukraine. This was Secretary of State Blinken during his visit to Beijing today on the possibility of new tariff penalties on China.
The question of tariffs, 301 measures, et cetera. What we're focused on is practices engaged in by China that are unfair and undermine our businesses and our workers. And this question of overcapacity is the one that is front and center. China is responsible for one-third of global production, but one-tenth of global demand. So there's a clear mismatch. And when you have products that are produced here and produced in a way that's heavily subsidized, heavily supported in other ways, and that allows those products then to be sold at low prices and sometimes below market prices in other countries, pushing businesses from those countries out of business and having potentially devastating effects on communities, on workers, on businesses, that's something that we have to, will, and are standing against.
Okay, we will find out where that goes and if it goes anywhere important. And speaking of finding out where things are going, finally, some real bipartisanship. The House is going to be voting on a campus anti-Semitism bill. The bill was introduced in Congress back in October, right after the attack by Hamas against Israel. And the bill would make some campus speech punishable. Speaker Mike Johnson threatened to take away university federal funding. And meanwhile, in the U.S. Senate, a U.S. Senator, Kirsten Gillibrand, senator from New York, voted alongside 29 other senators to co-sponsor the Bipartisan Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. It's a bill that would help address anti-Semitic sentiment and action on college campuses. That's been rising across the nation for years and spiking in the wake of Hamas's terrorist attack of October 7, 2023. The bill would authorize the U.S. Department of Education to consider the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance working definition of anti-Semitism when enforcing federal anti-discrimination laws. And Congressman Mike Lawler, the Republican from upstate New York, who was one of those Republicans who bravely confronted the pro-Hamas college crowd at Columbia University. Mike Lawler writes, the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act will help put a stop to the anti-Semitic intimidation of Jewish students on campus once and for all. I'm glad this bipartisan legislation will be coming up for a vote next week, and I urge all my colleagues to support it. I'm not sure that I share Congressman Lawler's enthusiasm. There's no one act that can deal single-handedly with a situation as dire as the current situation actually is. And for people who have First Amendment concerns, and I would just ask a question. If you believe that there is an attempt by this Anti-Semitism Awareness Act to define anti-Semitism too broadly, I'll just ask a basic question. If someone says, long live Adolf Hitler, or someone says, bless the Nazis for everything they've contributed to civilization, does that count as, by definition, anti-Semitic? No, of course it does. If you were Hitler's major focus in much of his life was the annihilation of the Jewish people. This was his purpose. You just have to read Mein Kampf. And of course, he came incredibly close. He killed the majority of the Jews in Europe. Not in the world, because thank God there was already a Jewish community, large and thriving Jewish community here in the United States. But the idea that praising the Nazis is anti-Semitic, it just seems to me axiomatic. It's obvious. Okay, so why is praising Hamas and supporting Hamas any less anti-Semitic than supporting the Nazis? The terrorists in Hamas are also committed to annihilating the Jewish people. And again, the level of killing that they achieved on October 7th, they weren't aiming at Israeli settlers. They weren't aiming at Israeli soldiers. They were aiming at people just because they happened to be Jewish, or in some cases, not even Jewish, just unlucky enough to have been in the only Jewish state in the world, which was invaded. If you are saying that you will not give up that article of the Hamas Charter that calls for the annihilation of Israel, then of course you are, by definition, not just anti-Israel, you are anti-Semitic. We will be right back with Unsung Hero, an unsung, at least so far, film that's worth attention. We'll be right back.
Your daily dose of debate.
I think you are the greatest debater on radio today.
The Michael Medved Show.
Wishing all people of goodwill the best possible enjoyment of the Sabbath coming up. Jewish Sabbath, of course, begins tonight. This is a Sabbath that occurs only once a year, and it's Shabbat, Chol HaMoed. It's the one Sabbath during the Passover holiday, so no delicious fresh-baked challah. We're still eating unleavened bread, eating matzah, and that for the rest of the Passover holiday, which continues for the first days of next week. But meanwhile, demonstrators aren't taking a holiday. I'm here in Phoenix, and with great appreciation for being able to use the facilities of KKNT AM, and very grateful for their hospitality. But in another part of town, at Arizona State University. Actually, it's not another part of town. It's another part of the state. But there was an attempt today to set up another solidarity with the Hamas tent city. It involved about 20 people at ASU, Arizona State University. And the whole idea was thrown into discomfort by the existence of sprinklers, which this time of year in Arizona come on early. And but they don't prevent people from expressing themselves very eloquently in musical and poetic terms. Listen. Okay, I have no idea what they were saying, but and neither do they. But better music is made by the people behind the movie, which we're going to be covering from Hollywood. The film is called Unsung Hero, and it's a true story which actually follows the adventures of a fairly remarkable family. And it's a family from Australia that has become a huge factor in the Christian music industry. But this is not one of those films where it's heavy-handed with its religious messages. It does have messages about goodness and about family and about survival. The family in question, which again has participated in every level of the production, even to an extraordinary extent, is the Smallbone family. And they were living in Australia where David Smallbone, the father of what became seven kids during part of the film, his wife is pregnant with their seventh kid. David Smallbone, who's played by his own son, which is actually uncanny because they really do look similar, was a promoter for music in Australia. And unfortunately, his career collapsed. And in a desperate move, he took an offer in Nashville, moving himself and six and a half kids with a baby on the way to Nashville to try to continue his career in faith-based entertainment. Listen.
Dad, I wrote a song. Thought maybe we could ask for an audition.
Oh, that's great, honey. Let's take it one step at a time.
Kay tells me you're a promoter. You know someone looking for one.
Well, I may know somebody who should be.
She's been given a beautiful voice. It's a miracle.
She's a special one, son. Your family, they're not in the way. They are the way.
There's no food. We're almost out of money.
I wonder if he's right. Maybe I'm not meant to sing.
Or maybe you're not meant to sing other people's songs.
Okay, that young lady, that's the performer known as Rebecca St. James, who has become a big favorite in Christian music. Her brothers, Luke and Joel Smallbone, she took the name St. James because Smallbone didn't sound right for a career. And her brothers have formed the singing duo King and Country, which also has achieved tremendous popularity. The film begins with the family in Australia and then shows some of the difficulties they have relocating to the United States. But there are little acts of kindness that help them along the way that are deeply touching. And the main religious theme in the film has to do with them finding community in a church near where they settled in Nashville, and showing the family and all of its members working to clean up people's lawns and to tend their gardens and to do things that are anything other than the glamorous fate that awaited this family. when it turns out that Rebecca, their talented daughter, really did have a marvelous voice. The film is a pleasure to watch. It is universally well acted. The relationships are never saccharine and beyond reproach. One of the things that I thought was very surprising in this film is that the main character, David Smallbone, the father of this very talented and likable brood, is not such a likable guy himself. He's a guy with problems, and some of the problems involving self-pity. And what it really does show is a wife, Helen Smallbone, is her name in real life, but in the movie, a wife who was amazingly thoughtful, strong, and focused on the positive. Generally, you leave the film feeling wonderful, which is not something that is always true. There is certainly a more of an emotional wallop than the current King Kong ex-Godzilla. And that's a different kind of film. But the unsung heroes here are basically not just the family itself that is the center of attention, but their neighbors, their friends, their fellow church members who help in a remarkable way. Recently, there was another film that had a somewhat similar theme, also based on a true story, called Hilary Swank starred. And that was called Ordinary Angels. And there are ordinary angels who take part in this film and this story as well. It's rated PG. Some of the arguments that are dramatized on film are a little bit harsh for very young viewers, but the PG rating is probably the most appropriate, though you could say, well, leaning over toward PG-13 because of some of the hardships that the family is forced to endure, including some health setbacks. It is in theaters, and I suspect it will be one of those films that surprises Hollywood by appealing to that audience that is out there that is deeply committed to religious faith. And just a final word about this Passover holiday, which is in traditional terms supposed to last for a full 8 days. And the first 2 days are full holidays, and the last 2 days are full holidays, and then there's a Sabbath in between, which begins tonight. And it's just been amazing to see the other families who are there, sometimes including four generations, who are there out participating in the Sabbath retreat, where there is every day there are five or six different classes on biblical text and biblical commentary and Jewish tradition, and plus conversations about our current events and some of our current dilemmas. To say that people aren't worried about what is going on in Israel, of course we are. And the best way to deal with that worry is to affirm hope, faith, kindness, a decency, and basically the Hebrew word is chesed, loving kindness.